This is Monocle on Design, our weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's show, we look at design for the community. We meet Yinka Ilori, a designer whose colourful installations have brightened up many a public space. In Switzerland, we visit Tableau Zurich, an outdoor gallery bringing art to the public. Also, we hear about a preschool in rural Vietnam that shows that good design can be found anywhere. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. We begin in Switzerland, where in the nation's largest city, you will find Tableau Zurich. Since 2013, the non-for-profit space has placed visual art into the public realm and played host to rolling exhibitions across the years. I caught up with Marcus Kraft, Tableau Zurich's founder, and Marion Ritzmann, the visual artist behind the current exhibition, Metric Pictures Drafts. But first, Marcus began by explaining a little bit more about the overall concept.
The setup itself is really simple. There are 7 freestanding stelen, and each one has 2 posters. So that makes 14 posters altogether. And the poster format is the standard Swiss poster format, which is called Weltformat or the World Format. It's very ironic because nobody in the world uses it except of the Swiss. And the artists that I am inviting, they always get the carte blanche, so they can do whatever they want. And for me, it's really amazing to see how these exhibitions also influence the whole atmosphere in this courtyard. The format is also very inclusive and democratic, you know. There are no barriers. We don't have, for example, a gallery door you have to open, because some people, they are still afraid of opening a gallery door and entering a gallery, especially when it comes to contemporary arts, because they might feel stupid, because they don't understand. For me, this is also a really important fact that Tableau Zurich is also there to make contemporary art a bit more approachable for people that would normally maybe never go to an art gallery. For example, a teenager from the countryside that comes to Zurich to go shopping. He might never go to an art gallery, but maybe he passes by Tableau Zurich and then he can look at the art if he likes it. The curational concept is that the invited artists, they have to either live in Switzerland or they would have to be born in Switzerland. Previous artists were like Walter Pfeiffer, for example, Shirana Shabasi, Yves Netzhammer, Beat Streuli, and so on. So it almost reads a bit like a who is who of contemporary arts in Switzerland. But I also like to spice up things a bit with up-and-coming artists that are maybe not so known yet in the international scene. A good example for that is probably the current exhibition, which is by Marion Ritzmann. And she's standing right next to me.
So Marion, big shoes to fill there, it sounds like. But I mean, I love this idea of it really being an open and inclusive space that really doesn't intimidate anyone. And you know, it is very public where it is. So I'd love to hear about, you know, firstly, how you kind of interpreted the space, like what you first kind of saw when you arrived and saw the opportunity, and then how you actually develop the art to work in that particular context and what you did there.
The first time when I have seen Tableau Zurich was kind of 5 years ago.
5 years ago?
Yes.
Whoa, that's a long time ago.
And it was kind of really inspiring. It was in the middle of the passage and you just could stand there and watching these tableaus. Mm. As a visual artist, my work process is also kind of to have a look at the in situ situation of exhibition space. So I also was fascinated from this courtyard. So, and I wanted to add there something which is also kind of with the architectural scene connected formally.
And you've kind of created these like bold geometric shapes, but also the colouring is almost like hand-colored. I don't know how you would describe it. You could probably describe it better than me. What is it exactly that you've designed there?
It's actually, as the title says, it's metric picture drawings. There are sketches. They are made for another work, for three-dimensional relief work. So they're really fast made, and it's pigments directly into the paper. This is also what you see if you are standing there, this haptic of the material.
As a city, Marion, Zurich, you know, it's quite amazing in the fact that they do have a lot of space for posters. There's a lot of cultural posters. I mean, there obviously is advertising, but there's a real emphasis in the city to champion the arts and creativity through both public art and, I guess, lots of posters. Do you feel like it's a city that really kind of promotes the idea of culture through the city, through the urban fabric, through public art? Do you feel that energy in Zurich?
I think, the graphic design of Switzerland is kind of famous. So I think also the posters in Switzerland, they're always specific concerning to this tradition. I think Tableau Zurich is in this case still very specific because it's not ad, and it's not ad for cultural events. It's art. So I think this is really unique.
For sure. And Marcus, maybe you want to add to that, because like there kind of is a lot of competition on poster boards across the city. So how is that kind of art factor and really making it feel curated really added to the strength of the project?
Yeah, we are really lucky that there are no other posters or billboards in this courtyard. So this is really the only place where we show something visually. So that makes it a lot easier to stand out, of course.
Just finally, guys, a question for both of you. I think this sort of commissioning of public art is really important, and the format is amazing in terms of it, you know, being limited in a way, but also kind of unlimited in terms of the possibilities. But just from both of you, I mean, what do you really think this provides a city in terms of, you know, adding value?
I think it's always valuable to see art, because I think art is something which does not have purposes which other stuff has. So it's kind of more open and free, and you just can be there and have a look if you feel any reaction to it. So I think it's kind of free.
I think Tableau Zurich is a good addition to the city because it's very simple. Is very approachable, and it changes every 6 months. So we can, of course, try things out. And if an exhibition might not interest you, you can always come back 6 months after and maybe you will see something amazing. In comparison to those permanent installations in public space, which are usually made for at least 10 years, oftentimes 20, 30 years, with Tableau Zurich, it's much more playful and much more direct, you know, in a way. We can also pick up on certain trends and be even more contemporary. And I'm really surprised that there are not more places like this in other cities.
That was Marcus Kraft, Tableau Zurich's founder, and Marion Rietzmann. The exhibition, Marion Rietzmann, Metric Pictures Drafts, is on show at Tableau Zurich until September 2021. To Vietnam now, where a small but growing community of seasoned architects are producing pro bono projects that have a meaningful impact on small communities. The Beaumont Preschool, designed by Ho Chi Minh City-based architecture firm Kien Truc O, is one example and provides a learning space and venue for local events. We hear now from writer Stephanie Pei, who reflects on why this particular project showcases how good design can be integrated into any surrounding.
Situated in Song La, a mountainous province in northern Vietnam, the Beaumont Preschool is attended by 70 children living in three villages nearby. While the original intent of the charity organization was to simply build two classrooms and a room for a boarding teacher, the architects took it a step further after considering the needs of the community. Having visited the province in the past, they believed that the space could be more than just an educational place. It could be a safe space for children who have nowhere to go after school as their parents work all day at the farms. It could also double up as a multi-purpose hall for the community to gather during festivals. The outcome is evidence that a lot can be done with limited resources, as long as one approaches it with positivity, openness, and a genuine desire to make lives better. The Bowman Preschool does not make a show, but exists in harmony with the endless terrain of mountains and trees. Seeing as the roads are unpaved at a rural site, everything had to be easy to transport and construct. The preschool is made of a simple steel structure and is clad with a local material composed of organic fiber and paper, chosen for its practicality, honest aesthetic, and waterproof properties. Double layers ensure that it is noise absorbing and temperature regulating, which is ideal for the harsh tropical climate. Yet the absence of fancy materials or high-end technology does not make it dull for its young inhabitants. Composed of the same material as the walls, the cloud-shaped roof possesses ventilation spots that enable natural light into the space. Dancing shadows are cast within the preschool as the sun changes its course throughout the day. The team believed that the practical needs of the children were as vital as their mental well-being. Inspired by vernacular stilt houses commonly found in rural areas of Southeast Asia, the preschool sits above ground. As well as preventing floods during the monsoon season, the raised platform enables the children to learn and play on an elevated plane, seemingly one with the clouds. The openness of the structure also blurs the inside and outside, inviting nature into the man-made dwelling and promoting a healing experience altogether. The Bowman Preschool proves that limitations posed by charity projects do not necessarily mean that the quality of architecture has to be compromised. For the architects, however, the most rewarding experience was witnessing the positive effects of their work firsthand. Shortly after its completion, the villagers gathered at the preschool to celebrate. For Monaco, I'm Stephanie Pei.
Over to London now, where the colourful works of artist and designer Yinka Ilori can be found across the city's boroughs. From a basketball court in Canary Wharf to enormous murals in London's Tottenham Court Road, his work is uplifting and often closely linked to the communities that he's working within. Unveiled earlier this year, the installation, As You Pass Me By, Know That It Is Nothing But Love From Me, is the first public artwork in a series that Yinka will roll out for the neighbourhood of Tottenham Hale. Monocle's Nick Manise paid a visit and met Yinka to discuss the desired impact of the piece on the local community.
This project, you know, is called As You Pass Me By, Know That It's Nothing But Love From Me. And I think this project was birthed out of lockdown. We spent the year kind of being at home and, you know, not seeing family or seeing friends. And I think it was just acts of kindness that we all sort of shared in our communities. You know, my neighbours who I didn't speak to for so long would knock on my door and ask me if I'm okay. Or just people you didn't know in the street would just be, you know, would smile or say hello. I think because we sort of shared a sort of common pain and it was a collective, you know, experience. So I wanted to try to sort of, you know, retell that narrative, allow us to remember what that was like, you know, that year of not being able to go out to the pubs or travel or see family and friends, and just remind ourselves that, you know, we can still continue to love each other even when you walk past someone.
Yeah, and I think that sort of became quite important, obviously, in this last year. Those people immediately around you sort of became your lifeline in many ways. Can you tell us how you sort of embody that in this artwork? Maybe describe the artwork for our listeners.
So it's a nightmeter hoarding that consists of a sort of kleidoscopic sort of colour palette. As you have orange, yellow. I mean, yeah, it's pretty much a really sort of colourful, vibrant hoarding that changes as you move along. But above your head is where the text sits, as long as you pass by. Now there's nothing but love from me. So I'm trying to take the audience and the passerby through a journey. So as they're going past this hoarding, they're going to read this message and hopefully make them smile or make them offer a smile to the next person that sort of passes by them. Yeah, that's the installation. But I think also during this whole year, I've been obsessed with pink. And there's something quite joyful about the colour pink and positive and youthful. And I want to bring that out. What I want to try and do is create a sort of, you know, an experience of kind of, you know, maybe it's a 2 or 3 minute experience that you might get from positive hoarding. And hopefully that will carry you through the whole day. And, you know, you might come back to it because you want to get that sort of that juice and that kind of, you know, that energy that you might probably, that you may not get anywhere else but in Tottenham.
And I think it's worth pointing out, you are wearing a pink hat right now, so that's right there.
I mean, my colour palette that I'm wearing today is I'm wearing a sort of pink camo hat and a sort of lilac jacket, which is the palette that you see on the installation today.
I mean, you talk as well about people maybe coming back or being drawn back to it and being uplifted by it. You've got a residency here for two years. What do you hope to sort of start to bring out of that local community over that 2 years? What do you hope you can offer them? I mean, this initial step's clearly about uplifting, but what else, I guess, are you hoping to do with your design for the community here?
I mean, for me, you know, Tottenham is a really special, you know, place, strong family links in Tottenham. You know, what is happening here, I think, is really special. I think not only for the community, but also for the younger community who are going to be the future and face of Tottenham. I think for me, having my work on Gangster Hoarding will hopefully inspire the next generation of artists, architects, designers, because, you know, what's been built is designed by the architects, designers. They have the creative vision. But also, I just want to inspire, you know, young kids who want to be, you know, future architects or designers, and let them know, you know, it's possible, you know, to be there. But also, it's about trying to give, you know, people that live in Tottenham a sense of pride and ownership of their community, because I think every kind of, you know, borough will have something that maybe may not be seen as positive. I think if you give them something that they're proud of, people are going to want to come down and be like, okay, have you seen that piece in Tottenham? So people have this sense of pride that, you know, I've got this installation here and it's mine. And I think what I like to try and do is, when I create work, is the work doesn't belong to me anymore. It belongs to the community. So over time it matures, you know, the people become the fabric of the artwork. But then also, I think for me, it's really important to try and make art, you know, inclusive in public spaces, because I think sometimes art can sometimes feel not inclusive. Whether it's in a gallery or a museum, because people might feel they don't belong or they can't access these spaces. Bringing art to your front doorstep and to people in their cars who stop in traffic looking at it, they're already in a gallery. That's the power of public art.
How do you, I mean, other than putting it in their community, giving it a physical presence, are you working with members of the community on upcoming pieces? How are you also engaging them perhaps in the making process as well?
Yeah, I think this particular project, we worked with Vicky, he was also one of the consultants on a project, and Argent. And as you know, there's different phases, you know, in this project. So I think the next phase, which would be, you know, during my residency, there will be a kind of community engagement process in this project, which we're still developing. But I mean, for me, you know, having the community involved in my process, I think is so key, because, you know, you see a lot of kind of public sculptures and artworks in public spaces that have no link to the community. They're just kind of plonked there. So there's no connection. They can't relate to what they're seeing. There's no, they can't create new memories or, you know, relive old memories. So I think for me, it's quite key to kind of, you know, always try and involve the art, you know, the community, whether it's young or old, or, you know, people that sort of feel disconnected to their community with all the kind of huge developments happening around. Bring them on that journey, because they will celebrate it. This is great what's happening in Tottenham, but in 20, 30 years' time, it's people behind me are going to carry that flag of Tottenham. So we need to bring them on that journey with us.
You're out in the communities working with people. You know, and I know you make things in the studio as well, but what do you get personally from being out in the community?
It's incredible, because, you know, you become a little bit vulnerable, because you sort of work in your studio every day of the year. You go into public space and you get to talk to young kids, adults, the elderly. They tell you their stories. Those stories is what fills me with inspiration to create new works of art. And there's a Nigerian musician called King Sunny Ade, and he says, the people are the fabric that I wear, and which means, in your last year me, Timo Fimbora, that's in Yoruba. And I think that is what my work's about. It's about the people. I get energy from the people and their stories and experiences and just their aura. And that just fills me with joy. And, you know, you can't, during lockdown, I missed being around people, being around my community. So, yeah, it's a very different experience from being in your office and around your team, but being in a community that has so much energy, inspiration, ideas, love. One of the biggest things you get in the community is love. And that's why the love sign is on that installation, because there is a lot of love in Tottenham, you know?
My thanks to Yinka Ilori. He was speaking to Nick Manise. And finally, on today's show, we stay in London to visit the new home of fashion boutique Browns. A former stalwart of South Molton Street, the brand has relocated their flagship shop to a new site in London's Mayfair. Fashion writer and friend of Monocle, Jamie Waters, paid the new premises a visit.
Browns' South Molton Street shop, a multi-storied place full of character and with a higgledy-piggledy warren of rooms, has been a London retail institution for 50 years. But as Paul Brennan, Browns' managing director, explains, when the Mayfair retailer hit its half century, it was time to move.
We almost didn't want to move from South Molton Street because of the history and the heritage with Browns. But what we knew we needed to do was enhance the experience, add in the new technology for the new luxury customer. And unfortunately, we realised that we wouldn't be able to do that in South Molton Street. We knew that we had to get some new premises to move into. So that was part of the reasons for the move, really. The great thing with this space here, we're only a few hundred yards down the road. We're adjacent now to Claridge's. We're still in the heart of Mayfair. And the provenance that the store has, the history and the heritage with Colfax and Fowler, no other boutique or no other brand being in this space, the DNA that it used to be a townhouse, the same as the store on South Molton Street. We felt that there's just a natural synergy, a natural move into this new location. And at the same token, it's been fully refurbished. So we've got all of the new technology in here. It's meaning that we can do the connected mirrors, meaning that we can add all of the functionality that the new customer wants, but behind the scenes without it being added on retrospectively.
When you enter the shop from Brook Street, you walk into the focus room, where there's a series of individual garments hanging, almost like an art installation. Each one is by an up-and-coming design talent, which makes sense. Browns has always been a champion of young designers.
Previously, Browns used to have another store opposite the main store called Browns Focus. And this is where Mrs. Bernstein really highlighted the most exciting new talent in the industry. And I think if you go back through the history of Browns, Mrs. Bernstein launched John Galliano, Comme des Garçons, Alexander McQueen. And so we wanted to stay true to that heritage with this space at the front of Brook Street. So this is our focus area. And at the moment, we've just launched 9 new designers and some of the hottest new talent in the industry. Some of these guys have really just started. Some of the guys, they've already got a bit of a following, but we wanted to give them a space where they can really shine and be showcased to the customer.
Browns is owned by Farfetch, one of the biggest fashion e-commerce platforms and a major innovator when it comes to digital systems. Unsurprisingly, there are plenty of digital innovations in this physical space.
So as you come into the store, you will have the opportunity to download the app or connect with the app. So immediately you can start this new level of experience with us as we talk about a connected customer journey. So as you come in, if you open the app, it will then register that you're in the store, and you'll immediately then be able to understand what pieces that are in your wish list are in the store. You could add items to your wish list by scanning the QR codes. You can learn about the designers that are in the store rather than just looking at a designer name on a tag. Learn about their range, see more of the product range. You can connect then to a style advisor in the store who could then say, okay, Jamie, we know that you like neighborhood. Well, we haven't got neighborhood in the store, but we've actually got Greg Lauren, which is a similar taste to you. We know from your order history, we know what sizes you take, what price points you spend around. So we can start building much more of an engaged experience for you than if you just walked in off the street. At the same time, then you can book an appointment with a stylist, go up to our VIC suites, use the connected mirror, which will again showcase all of the products that you have in your wish list. If they're not in the store, we could then get them bought into the store for you. Also, working with Farfetch, we'll then be able to expand across all of the Farfetch range as well. So you have the potential to look at almost 250,000 products just in one store, in one visit.
The store is a striking example of combining new with old. The building that now houses the shop has a long and storied history, and Browns has been careful to celebrate this heritage while simultaneously making the space feel fresh and modern.
The building itself used to be owned by a lady called Nancy Lancaster, who set up Colfax and Fowler, the interior design business. outside of Buckingham Palace, this store is the only other building that is listed internally and externally. We've been able to put all of the new technology in, whether it be the Wi-Fi, all of the other pieces for the connected journey, but we've had to stay true to that heritage. The building itself is over 100 years old. The yellow panes, that's a listed colourway. So all of the work that we did had to be signed off by the Heritage Commission to ensure that we still stayed true to the DNA. But for us as well, it's great that it still links back to Brown's history itself. South Molton Street was 5 townhouses all converted. This in itself, then being a residency, feels that we're still keeping that link with Brown's history. But no other retailer, no other brand or boutique has been in this space. So it's something that we can say now is truly our forever home, but is still that connected new luxury experience. And so we have the courtyard, which I think everyone who's come into the space never knew existed in London. I mean, people who've been here for decades never knew that there was this secret hidden oasis behind Claridge's. Dumouré Studios have got an excellent portfolio of work where they've blended the new and somewhat the old, or kept the heritage and the history and the DNA in the spaces that they've worked in. That was really why we chose them as a key partner, because we knew that then we could do fantastic new installations and fixtures with modern materials, coppers, brass, bright customized light fittings, etc., but also still staying true very much to the heritage and the provenance of the store, whether it be the sanded back floors, the marble on the wall, the high ceilings, all of the hand-painted finishing with some of the wallpapers, blending those two so you have a modern, sophisticated luxury retail experience. We feel that as we're standing here in this space, the metallic carpet works well with the sanded back floor, with then the marble on the walls and the brass fixtures, the bold lighting, but then looking out with the big paneled doors. It all works exceptionally well. I think Dumouré have done a fantastic job for us to deliver that.
Across the fashion industry, much has gone into elevating the retail experience in recent years. But one thing has remained the same. The vast majority of boutiques and department stores are still organised by brand, with each designer receiving a rack. Browns doesn't think this makes sense.
When we were looking at the store layout, we knew that we still needed to be somewhat conventional. We needed to make sure that there is a jewellery area. Sneakers, of course, it has been a huge booming category for menswear, for womenswear for a number of years now, so we knew we needed a dedicated space there. Although in Browns East, we do have more genderless merchandising experience, but that's more relevant to the East London customer, the experience in East London. Here we knew that we still needed to have men's in one floor, women's on another floor. But what we've decided to do differently is merchandise the product by look and by theme rather than by designer, which is how customers shop and is how we've all been shopping online to a degree as well. Conventional stores will simply have an entire fixture of Fendi, an entire area of Gucci. We wanted to actually say, when you come into the store, you'll see a colour palette or you'll see a theme that will inspire you, but you'll see designers that maybe you've never normally looked at. You'll see products that maybe you wouldn't have normally seen if you'd have just walked into that Fendi space or if you'd have just walked into that Gucci space. So the aim really is to give the customers a more exciting way of shopping, which is more in line with just naturally how we behave. It's very rare that you'll see someone head to toe in one designer label. And at the same token, we want to then just help customers expand their portfolio where naturally we'll go for the same things. If we can show the suiting with casual wear, with different designers, it just makes for a more exciting experience for the customer, we think.
For Monocle, I'm Jamie Waters.
And that's all the time we have on today's show. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, then catch our 5-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced and edited by Maylie Evans. Thanks to our researchers, Nick Manise and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.